For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everybody. Many of you know me. Some of you do not. My name is Nyozan Eric Schutt, one of the priests here. Our teacher, Taigen Daniel Layton, is having a well-earned day off, hopefully resting at home or something like that. And but nonetheless, we wanted to continue our tradition of having a half-day or one-day sitting every month, and so here I am. And like I said, some of you know me, and I know many of you. I don't know all of you. Is there anybody who's here for the absolute first time? No. Great. So good. Well, so you're kind of familiar with how this goes. My Dharma talk today, something I've been milling over for a bit, and it only kind of crystallized in the on the bus ride up on the way up how I actually wanted to present the sort of constellation of ideas, and so we'll see how it goes. And as it turns out, I left the talk home with apparently everything else that I was supposed to print out and bring here. So I'm glad that I was still revising it. We'll hope it goes reasonably well. What I would like to do, basically, is just kind of talk to you about some experiences that I've had in the recent past. And they really happening in conjunction had a big effect on me, and so they have prompted some thoughts about practice in general, and you know, the nature and limitations of my own practice. And so I want to share that with you, and we'll have some time for discussion. We'll have discussion later in the afternoon for the people who are staying for the one day, but for the rest of you, we'll leave some time for questions and answers. I'd like to start by reading just a little bit of one of the chants that we do here. We don't do it often. We mostly do it during longer retreats, 3 days or 5 days. And the name of the chant is Great Ancestor Dogen's Verse for Arousing the Vow. Ehe koso hatsu ganmon. The vow in question here is, I think, kind of related to the what we call bodhicitta, or arousing the aspiration to awakening, to waking up. And this is the very end of the chant. As quietly studying and mastering these causes and conditions, one is fully informed by the verified Buddhas. With this kind of repentance, certainly will come the inconceivable guidance of Buddha ancestors. Confessing to Buddha with mindful heart and dignified body, the strength of this confession will eradicate the roots of wrongdoing. This is the one color of true practice, the mind of faith, the true mind of faith, and the true body of faith. There's some language in here that we're not all that familiar with in our usual discourse, what we talk about most often. We're talking about repentance, confession. We recently had a visitor here at the temple, Daigaku Rume, very eminent Soto practitioner in North America, who spoke about repentance, but this language is kind of not our usual language. It's something you might more often hear in a church. Although we do this vow in our services regarding acknowledging our ancient twisted karma and stuff, which is related. But the part of this passage that I'm sort of picking up on is this emphasis on causes and conditions, you know, this net of causes and conditions that we're all embedded in, this notion of pratitya samudpada, or dependent co-arising, essential in Buddhist teachings. People are familiar with the concept of Indra's net, perhaps. And this notion of sort of like looking at ourselves in this web of causes and conditions and sort of acknowledging, I really need to do something different. This is maybe a kind of repentance. And with that, I think there's the associated idea of maybe a kind of a forgiveness, sort of like both recognizing and giving up on unskillful, unhelpful ways of behaving within this net, this massive net of things that are influencing our daily lives. But then also not letting ourselves off the hook, but also not giving ourselves a hard time in ways that are not helpful. It's all kind of forgiveness. So these experiences that I had, these happened towards, I think it must have been maybe in April, maybe even late March. I live on the south side. I live on the very northern edge of the neighborhood of Woodlawn, which people may be familiar with the name. Oftentimes, it turns up in the news. It's kind of a troubled place. A lot of my life is directly north of there in the neighborhood of Hyde Park, and they're separated by the Midway Plaisance, if people are familiar with that. It's a kind of a wide, it's actually a park, Boulevard Park. So there are two sort of fairly big roads with a big green space between them. And historically, that has very much been a border between these two communities. And during the winter, so there's the University of Chicago campus, and then probably 3/4 mile to the east, there's a steam plant and a chiller plant that provides steam and hot water for the heating and needs of the university. And underneath the Midway, or not the road, but in some of the park area, there are tunnels that can, you know, connect these to transport that. And on these tunnels, during the winter, there are steam grates, and steam comes up. And you're shaking your head. You've probably seen this, because you cross the Midway a lot, too. And there are people who live on these vents for the winter. Given that they're living there, the people are quite destitute. In my experience over the many years, it's always men. These guys tend to set up, I don't know, in October, and they usually get kind of pushed out. I don't know if it's by the police or the university, kind of towards the end of winter. And in the meanwhile, they more or less live on these grates. And, you see these collections of, you know, sleeping bags and blankets and shopping carts and bicycles that sort of grow there through the winter. These people just trying to live. And on this day in question, quite early in the morning, I was walking across it to the north, probably 5:30 or 6, and I saw this woman pull up in this car, this van kind of thing, and step out and, you know, walk over to one of these places where, you know, it's early, so presumably the guy was there and still sleeping, and set something down. And I thought, what is that? And I realized, oh, she's I was quite far away. I think she's giving him food. And then she went back to her van, the car, and drove like 60 yards down to the next one and hopped out of her car again. And I thought, she's giving him food. And I was like, you know, somehow really moved by this. And, you know, so I called out and said, thank you for doing that. And, you know, she didn't hear me. And she kind of looked and got back in her van, went down to the next one. You know, so started, I'm here and she's down here and then like this. And that was the direction I was walking. So I was walking there, and as I was getting closer, I tried again. I said, thank you for that. And, you know, she looked at me and still didn't quite hear me, and then looked very troubled and started, you know, walking sort of rapidly, still to the next guy, right? But I got the impression that she was afraid of me. You know, it was early in the morning. You know, nobody else is around. I'm a man. She's a woman. I'm white. She's black. Whatever the reasons, you know, she thought this is an interaction she maybe didn't want, I think. But, you know, as I got closer, I tried again. I said, you know, I called out. And I said, thanks. And she turned around and looked at me. And I said, thank you for what you're doing. And she kind of relaxed. And I approached her. And I said, you know, I don't know. I just found that. Thank you. I find this really moving. And she said, you know, these guys live out here. There are all kinds of people who are hungry and, you know, have problems with the world, this kind of thing. My daughter's in the car, and I want her to learn. She's eight. I think she said she's eight. And I want her to learn that even, you know, even if there are problems you can't solve, you can at least be kind. And, you know, I said something like, well, you know, gosh, yeah, it's easy to forget that. You know, I forget sometimes that I can do anything. There are people who would say this is not the kind of thing you can do, should do. That's another debate, but or question. But I said, I forget that too, and I'm just, it's good to be reminded that whatever the circumstances, you can be kind. And she smiled broadly, and she opened her arms, and we hugged each other, and we both cried for a minute. And I don't know, I mean, it was just a very moving thing. And then she went on with her day, and I went on with my day. Around this time, there was a speaker for the meeting associated with the Parliament of the World Religions at happened at the University of Chicago. A woman named Xiaolan Hu wrote a book a few years ago called This Worldly Nibbana, about the social teachings of early Buddhism, which I found very good. I'd recommend it. She gave this paper, because I'd like the book, I went to see her, and in this paper, she said something, she was talking about dependent co-arising that I mentioned earlier, causes and conditions, and she says, interdependent co-arising is often understood to mean a fuzzy sense of interdependence, but anyone in the field of Buddhist studies, this was an academic crowd, Buddhist studies, or we could say just practice Buddhism, knows that it can potentially take forever to expound the implications of co-arising. One of the implications is dynamic interconditionality. Because of co-arising, a person is conditioned by his or her surroundings and experiences, and so each of us is different, since each of us co-arises with different experiences. At the same time, because of co-arising, our physical, verbal, and mental actions condition each other's, positively and negatively. That is to say, because of co-arising, suffering travels in the interconnected web of life, and happiness travels too. Are you having trouble hearing me? Okay, I'll try to speak up. Suffering travels in the interconnected web of life, and happiness travels too. She points out that she attributes this notion of interconditionality or whatever to Joanna Macy, her book one of her books. It's not one that Mutual Causality in Buddhism and General Systems Theory. I don't remember having read that, but so she, Joanna Macy gets credit. You know, this was very dramatically demonstrated to me that, you know, I'd had this experience with this woman, and it sort of was buoying. It gave me, like, it was a very positive thing. I'm sure I was a much more positive person through the rest of the day in my interactions, and it was true. I mean, it's like, you know, maybe we're not going to solve the problems of the world, but, you know, taking care moment to moment of our little spot, and whether completely skillful or not, always trying to act kindly, you know, not only is there, you know, maybe limited, but there's an immediate benefit and there's a tendency to spread. We don't know what the limits of that are. But for a Buddhist practitioner, for someone, at least a Mahayana practitioner committed to Mahayana practice, seems like a worthy thing to keep in mind, and had been demonstrated so graphically for me. Right. The next day, the very next day, I am walking down Woodlawn Avenue. Some of you know the street. Just south, just approaching the Seminary Co-op bookstore, walking that way, and I see a person take a bag of, you know, garbage, apparently, litter, and chuck it under a car, kind of like chuck it under a car. And it really aroused something in me. This is a problem on my block. We have a lot of people who drive down the alleys and toss out whole bags of garbage, and you know, so it's not a good thing. And you know, basically, it's something I've grown kind of reactive to, because it's, you know, it's disrespectful of people, it's disrespectful of the world, or it strikes me that way. So it bothered me. You know, this is probably 50 yards away. Couldn't really see who was doing it. And so I just keep walking along. And as I pass this other person, it turns out to be a woman, you know, she says something, can you give me some money? Or can you help me? And I said, not if you're going to be throwing garbage all over the neighborhood, and look at her for the first time. And what I saw was another African-American woman. I don't know how old she was. She seemed quite old. But obviously somebody who had been living on the streets for a long time, you know, maybe had problems with mental health, maybe had problems with addiction, maybe it experienced a lot of violence and trauma in her life. And I said this thing without looking, and I looked into her face, and I saw that what I brought to that moment and added to whatever that was shame. I shamed this woman. It was truly, I felt a shameful thing that I did, sort of carelessly, right? And I was very rattled by it. I mean, I immediately, like, wow, this is not right. What happened here? But I couldn't quite parse it. I couldn't quite wrap my head around it. So I kept walking. She kept walking. But it, like I said, it shook me, and so I kept thinking about it. And It was so dramatic a contrast to what had been so clearly modeled for me by somebody else the day before, presumably not a Buddhist, and and instead of what I experienced in the previous day of somebody doing something of whatever limited nature that brought some kindness and at least good intention, and experiencing how that spreads, I could see that I had done this like terribly, terribly mean thing to this other woman, and not only brought, you know, whatever degree of unhappiness into her life, I was extremely unhappy with myself. And, you know, I've been practicing Buddhism for a long time. You know, we're always told to pay attention, to look. And I was just sort of blithely going along, and somebody triggered something in me, and boom, you know, I brought nothing productive into the situation, at least in the immediate sense. And, you know, so clearly, I just dropped that. So, you know, it's just very clearly was totally counterproductive, and it was like as soon as there was a glance, you know, as soon as there was a look, just a bit of connection, like even being willing to see this person, it was clear that my concerns about, litter, say, these issues of like not treating other people, not treating the earth, not treating physical world materials respectfully, that's a very important one. But in the context of this particular person's life and what that particular person was, I presume, experiencing and had been for a long time, was so out of whack, so disproportionate, so out of balance. And I was reminded of, as I've been thinking about this, where Dogen, the 13th century, I think all of you know this, but for those of you who don't, he's sort of the Japanese ancestor at the head of our tradition, a great Japanese teacher, 13th century, and one of his masterworks, Genjo Koan. He says towards the beginning, to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. This idea of carrying oneself forward, I think that's exactly what I was doing in the moment with the second person. I was completely wrapped up in my own sort of preferences, my own sort of sense of how I thought the world was supposed to be, how I thought people were supposed to behave, you know, how I wanted people to treat my neighborhood, all this kind of stuff that I was completely, it was like this cloud of dust that kept me seeing something that in the moment I think was actually much more important. I have no policy towards, you know, the seemingly intractable, insoluble problem of poverty, people on the street. It's very, for me, I'm always sort of troubled by it. Sometimes I will help people out a little bit. Sometimes I won't. But I've never, I've never been the kind of person to like walk by and say, why don't you get a job or do this or do that? If I'm not going to come do something for somebody, I would say, I'm sorry, I can't, or not today, or something like that. But this thing of doing something mean was kind of a shock. And as I said, but it really made me start to think about this idea of carrying yourself forward and, what that actually means. And, I've had a sense of that. But the thing is, when we you know, we there's a koan by with Rinzai Linji. I won't talk about the whole thing, but he says something like there's a line something like, you know, in this lump of red, 6 foot lump of red flesh or 5 foot lump of red flesh, whatever it is, there is a true person of no rank coming out the portals of your face, you know, through your eyes and ears and your nose and mouth and everything. There's this true person, you know. What is that? I don't know. You know, usually, and then he says, look, look. And, you know, I've always taken that, so, okay, you know, I'll look and I'll be looking for that big person, you know, that true person of no rank, no position, the person who sort of everywhere and nowhere, the person who's sort of living out, expressing Buddha mind, big mind, or whatever. And, you know, so I think in our practice there's this orientation of you. We're sort of aspiring and looking to that. But we take it for granted that, you know, the little self, you know, the small, cramped position, person of preferences and attitudes is completely obvious to us. And it's not. You know, and this was an instance where I did something in interaction with another person, relationship to another person, that became, that kind of flushed out something about myself that I wasn't really aware of. And in that sense, it was a very, you know, it was upsetting and cruel what it had done, but good. You know, Dogen in this thing I quoted, you know, says that those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Now, I'm not saying this realization of my own delusions is not, you know, in and of itself put me to Buddha, you know. I mean, but, you know, it's a very sort of crisp kind of a wake up. And therefore, for, in some sense, good. Shouldn't have happened, but in some sense, good. I was reminded by all this of this passage that I remember from a long time ago, one of the very early works of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher, that it was in a book called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. He says, disappointment, different context, but he says, disappointment is the best chariot to use on the path of Dharma. It does not confirm the existence of ego and its dreams. You know, this little sense we have of, I'm a really decent guy. As a matter of fact, I'm a Buddhist priest, you know. However, if we are involved with spiritual materialism, this idea we talk about here in terms of practicing with gaining idea, trying to bolster self, says if we're involved with spiritual materialism, if we regard spirituality as part of our accumulation of learning and virtue, if spirituality becomes a way of building ourselves up, then of course the whole process of surrendering is completely distorted. And then he says, we must surrender our hopes and expectations, as well as our fears, and march directly into disappointment, work with disappointment, go into it, and make it our way of life, which is a very hard thing to do. Disappointment is a good sign of basic intelligence. It cannot be compared to anything else. It is so sharp, precise, obvious, and direct. And this was truly an instance of that. It was just like such a acute, I mean, not, I don't want to overestimate it, but it was so precise and so clear that my sense of myself and how I was in the world was a little bit off and needed a little bit more scrutiny. And in that sense, as I say, it was, you know, this realization, the delusion itself, and being able to have it sort of flushed out in a way that sometimes it isn't, was a good thing. You know, we often talk about, well, to use another passage from Dogen, you know, another very famous way, it says to study the Buddha way is to study the self. you know, and I think he's there talking about, you know, me and you. These people are walking around with all our stuff. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. To be actualized by myriad things, I think this is the idea. This is finding, having some kind of contact with what we talk about as big mind, or this true person of no position that Rinzai talks about. But you can't approach that any other way than through the sort of steady work of I don't know what the term would be, working with this limited being that we are, and sort of seeing through the ways that, you know, the phrase that Taigen uses often is you know, seeing our own greed, hate, and delusion, right? And that seeing our own greed, hate, and delusion, and that's the way that, you know, as we sort of work with that, not that the greed, hate, and delusion necessarily is going to go away totally, or that small self is going to go away, but as we start to see through that, start to see how it functions, starts to see the condition, see our own conditionality, start to see that what I take as a straightforward thing, you don't go around making messes, is actually a very conditioned thing. That's part of the process, right, of this bigger project. And you have to do both. It's not a narcissistic, like, you know, going to sort myself all out exactly. It's not that kind of spiritual materialism kind of thing or gaining idea. But it is this very sort of, like, careful, it's a cultivation. It's a cultivation, right? And, you know, not to be disdained in our practice, even though it's painful and uncomfortable. And as a matter of fact, it's far preferable in the long run to fostering illusions of, you know, I mean, maybe it's not, but if it is an illusion, as it is for most of us, that we don't have stuff to work on, it's good to get rid of that as quickly as we can. And the way we do that is by disappointing ourselves, disappointing our friends, and not giving up on it, and you know, resolving to do something different, and, you know, and forgiving ourselves, basically. And, you know, both, you know, since I've talked about Suzuki Roshi and Chögyam Trungpa in the same breath, Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, he had this image that he said, you know, talked about the manure field of Bodhi. You know, like, we don't take the, you know, we don't get rid of all the crap of our personality. We use it to nurture, to fertilize our practice, right? And Suzuki Roshi says a very similar thing. He talks about mind weeds. He says when we cultivate, when we work to get rid of those, well, not get rid of, when we're tending, we're cultivating, we don't throw that stuff away. We compost it. We plant it. Or you mix it into the soil near. And that's what nurtures our practice. So, anyway, I just wanted to share that with you because it was I don't know, maybe there are implications to it that I haven't seen that you can bring out, but it was just it was a very sharp and very disappointing experience, but I think I learned something from it, so I can't regret it. Anyway, I went on a bit long. I'll stop. If there are a few questions or comments, I of course welcome them. Did you have a question? Oh, okay. What sort of what? Oh, greed, hate, and delusion.
Greed, hate,
and delusion. Or or sometimes it's said passion, aggression, or ignorance. So these are, in basic Buddhist teachings, what we call the three poisons. They are the things that we engage in. They're unskillful ways of relating to the world that we use to sort of bolster and protect and defend a false sense of self that sees the self not as in complete relation with all other things, and actually, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's phrase, actually co-arising, interbeing, one, if you will, but rather something separate, completely separate, which seems to be our usual way of going about things and tends to cause us problems. I'm sorry, was I speaking unusually softly today? Usually I'm very loud.
You are much softer than you usually.
Really? Okay, sorry about that. Listen to the recording, I guess. Yeah, Douglas.
I think this is a very interesting topic. It's not the sort of thing we think of with Zen. We tend to speak in terms of sitting on the cushion and having some sort of mindfulness as we go through life. And this was, the moment we can recognize what you have done. That in itself is a kind of awakening, I think, and it's important for us to do that, to recognize when we have acted in that kind of automatic, self-centered way.
Very self-centered way.
Delusion. And I think it's important for us to recognize that and then say, okay, that I wish I hadn't done that. Going forward that you want. I think the good thing is, I think people, maybe not so much, I think our society has changed. I think in the past people would have taken something like that and really beaten themselves up over it, said, I must be a really horrible person. And I don't think that's very fruitful either. But I think practicing the precepts is very much exactly that kind of thing. You recite the precepts and consider how we have lived up to that and recognize that and resolve to do better, to act more generously, compassionately, fairly, kindly. I don't think we speak about that in Zen as much as we might.
I appreciate your bringing up the precepts. When I was been mulling these things over in the last few days, I thought about them a lot. And a lot of times in Zen circles, there's this language of practice as a kind of container. And I have to admit, I invite anybody to explain that to me. I've never quite understood what that means. But and so I was thinking, well, what instead? And I was thinking, okay. Practice as this kind of pebble, or a field of rocks in the stream, right? And we sort of bump up against them, and it makes us see something. And the precepts are exactly that. We by consciously engaging with the precepts, it makes us aware of, it makes, as I said, we take it as this small self is transparent, and it's not until it bumps up against something. And, the precepts can be that in our daily life, and it makes us go, oh yes, right? Or even our breath in Zazen, where, the breath takes us out of, keeps interrupting that production of self-interested, self-involved monitoring of thoughts and environment in a way to protect itself. So the precepts are really important. And I appreciate what you said. I don't know if it's just a cultural thing, this thing about beating yourself up. I do that a lot. But I realized, it was part of this whole experience. I realized that's this kind of a thing. It's just not helpful. Sarah.
Yeah, thank you so much for that talk. It was very poignant. It made me a lot about kind of how uncomfortable and unpleasant that feeling of disappointment or shame, or like when we bump up against that part of ourselves that, you know, I like to convince myself doesn't exist, or I've gotten over somehow, and how it seems like one of the things that our practice can do is a container insofar as that becomes a space where we can feel that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And allow it to kind of be what it is without grasping onto it and beating ourselves up with it, but also not pushing it away and kind of throwing it out, but kind of letting it kind of be there.
Yeah.
And let it teach us whatever it is that, you know, kind of trace it back to where it came from in that moment, which it seems like you were able to do kind of very, very quickly in a way, kind of realize so fast.
That's actually, thank you for that description of container, because that does make sense to me. And I think it makes also the very important point that, you know, none of us are perfect people. We've got ancient twisted karma. And, you know, so it's not like practice is going to prevent you from encountering those things. Rather, exactly what you said. Practice enables you to see them and work with, and then do something, you know, and then you probably have to do it again, but yeah.
Thank you. That is the point I was going to make. You told us two very dramatic stories, but I realize that every day we experience both of those things all the time.
Yes.
We experience examples of something wonderful that are inspiring, and then us being an asshole or whatever, in whatever small way. But we have to notice them and learn from them. And that's what our practice, I think, can do if you call attention, as you did today, to that. So thank you for that. I mean, as you were telling that story, I was thinking, oh yeah, there was that guy. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of thoughts, not nearly as powerful stories, but the touched us in a way. But they're the same thing. They're these learning opportunities, or growing opportunities, all the time.
Yeah. David. Yes.
The moment I start seeing myself better than anybody else, I suffer.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so I'm struck when you're telling the story. I see that. And, you know, like Yoshi said, you know, all the time, every day it comes up, you know. You can come here to sit zazen, you know, going down National Avenue 50 miles an hour, so I figure out how time to meditate.
Yeah, yeah. Cutting people off in traffic, right?
But what is our intent when we come to an action? You know, if our intent is filled with judgment, you put garbage under the car, then it separates. You know, so what I have to do, like, we all have to do, and I appreciate you saying it, it brings it up. What is my intent to every action? How can I let go of the good stuff I've done and not cling to that and be able to be present in just this moment?
And both of those things require sort of a certain degree of being awake in the moment. And that's what our time on the mats and cushions helps inculcate.